The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for our blind and print-impaired audience. It's the Indie Week, the Independent Weekly Journal, and it's read by John Federson today. And the date of publication, October the 10th of 2024. We begin this issue with the Durham Association of Educators scores a long-sought, if partial, win. After months of advocacy, the DAE is a big step closer to securing a seat at the table with the Durham School System administrators. At its meeting last week, the school board stopped short of adopting this formal meet-and-confer policy, as DAE has requested instead. The board directed the superintendent of schools, Anthony Lewis, to work with DAE's leadership to develop a new policy for board review. Mika Tweetmeyer, president of DAE, said in an interview, "It feels like finally all the things we've been saying, people were understanding." As she spoke, two DAE members sporting the organization's bull-logoed red apparel walked by and paused to high-five Tweetmeyer. Prior to the meeting, the DAA held an umbrella-filled rally in the rain. Vice President Christy Patterson says, "We are here tonight to say no to union busting and yes to union rights and democracy." The board's action came after two earlier proposals were tabled due to legal concerns. Board member Natalie Beyer asked of the policies, "Are either of them ready for action this evening?" Eva Dubuisson, the attorney present, said, "I would say no, neither." North Carolina is one of the few remaining states where public sector employees are prohibited from engaging in collective bargaining. Thus, a meet-and-confer policy must be carefully worded to stay within state law. Further, North Carolina's Equal Access Act orders, quote, "schools not favor nor endorse an education employee association." In response, the board directed staff to develop a broad meet-and-confer policy, one that could apply not just to DAE, but to any group that represents over half employees. After that measure passed in a 4-3 split vote, the crowd of DAE members audibly gasped in excitement at the decision. While Superintendent Lewis did not set an exact timeline to complete the formal policy, he said, "I think from my seat, it's not a matter of if, but when we will pass a meet and confer policy." Next, also from Durham, Duke University, a building has been renamed for George Wall, as his ancestors emphasize he was one of millions. Hundreds of university and Durham community members filled a narrow banquet hall inside Duke's East Campus Student Center on September 27th. For a presentation to honor the legacy of former Duke employees George W. Wall and his son, George Frank Wall. Originally, the ceremony had been scheduled to take place on the East Campus Quad, but tornado warnings and high winds from Hurricane Helene meant the university could not take chances. Relocating the ceremony wasn't going to damp the excitement, though. Adam Silver, chair of the Duke Board of Trustees and current NBA commissioner, told the crowd, "This dedication was scheduled to take place outside, and because of the rain and the tornado warning, the powers that be decided to bring it in here. But I think the Wall family never had a doubt that the sun was going to come out for this ceremony." Earlier this year, Duke's board voted to rename that student center, the East Campus Union, until now, the Wall Center for Student Life, in dedication to that family and their decades of service to the university. Beginning at 1870, at the age of 14, George Wall, a formerly enslaved person, worked as a property steward for Trinity College in Randolph County. In 1892, Wall followed the school's move to Durham at the request of the university president then, John F. Crowell. In the years that followed, Wall saved enough money from working overtime to purchase a plot of land for $50 near East Campus to build his family a one-story cottage. More working-class black families eventually moved into that neighborhood that would come to be known as Walltown, in honor of George Wall's commitment to that community. His son, George Frank Wall, followed closely in his father's footsteps, helping with caretaking duties as a child before taking a more integral role after George Wall's death. Both George and George Frank forged deep relationships with staff and students during their decades working at the university. Three descendants, Stephanie Joy Tisdale, Vanessa Wall Smart, and Talib Graves Manns, gave remarks on behalf of the roughly 50 family members in attendance. Tisdale opened her remarks with an invocation from West African Yoruba culture about honoring ancestors, before reflecting on the history of slavery and its impact on the Wall family. Tisdale said, "George Wall is one of millions. He represents one of the millions of human beings of African descent born in captivity, forced to labor against their will, navigating the world as best as possible, all variables considered. The fact this land continues to be called Walltown almost 120 years later speaks to an aspect of George Wall's existence that I want to know more about." She continued by drawing connections between Walltown and other prominent black institutions like North Carolina Central and Hayti, linking their shared history as an important chapter in the ever-evolving story of people of African descent in Durham. Smart, a more soft-spoken storyteller than her cousin, shared stories about what life was like in the recent decades for Walltown residents, saying, "Not unlike many communities in Durham, in Walltown there was a network, a sense of belonging, love, and a safe space for its residents, whether related by blood or the boundaries of the neighborhood. Many black neighborhoods like Walltown, built after Reconstruction, had to be self-sufficient, relying on the skills and trades of people in the community, as Jim Crow laws prevented them from accessing resources like health care and education elsewhere." As Smart listed off names of people and places that played an important role in the neighborhood's history, attendees in the crowd responded with mm-hmm and celebratory finger snapping. Before his death, in 1953, George Frank left a $100 gift to the university to be used as a scholarship fund in recognition of his family's contributions to the school. Graves Manns, the last of the descendants to speak, said he smiles, thinking about how that gift, quote, "is likely the first philanthropic endowment commitment from a black person to Duke University." Graves Manns moved to Durham in 2014 when he was chosen as the Google for Startups Entrepreneur in Residence for a startup community called Hub American Underground. He was familiar with the area, having spent time visiting family in Walltown as a child, and he drew parallels to his ancestors' own entrepreneurial story of perseverance, while also noting that George and George Frank were driven by a different set of circumstances. Gravesman said, "It is important to remember that George's decisions were likely driven by his need to survive. The opportunities he faced were shaped by choices none of us have had to make. Decisions about his physical safety, his freedom, and the future of his family." In 2018, Graves Manns created Knox Street Studios, a community hub for, quote, "programs that strengthen entrepreneurs and create ownership opportunities." In the same neighborhood where his family's legacy began, something that Graves Manns said was a no-brainer when he came to Durham a decade ago. He charged the audience to make the same investment in their community that he and his great-granduncle George Frank made in theirs. He told the crowd, "I challenge each of you to ask yourself, am I doing all that I can to lead the community better than it was when I found it? Let this be a reminder that your contribution, no matter how big or small, has the power to change lives and communities. So I ask you, what will your legacy be? What is your $100 and where will you invest it?" Over 100 years ago, after the founding of Walltown, the neighborhood is at a crossroads. Encroaching redevelopment has left a historically working-class black community with only a handful of black homeowners. An ongoing battle over the redesign of nearby Northgate Mall has neighbors worried about the impact on their property taxes. When Graves Manns goes on runs on the path around Duke East Campus, he says he wonders what his ancestors would think about the million-dollar houses in place of the homes built by their family and friends. These conversations are happening at Duke University, celebrates its 100th anniversary. Attendees expressed excitement about the milestone and Duke's relationship with the city, but also did not shy from calling for further community investment. President Vincent Price said, "Our centennial is an opportunity to reflect on and continue to deepen the university's commitment to purposeful partnerships here in our hometown. Through our strategic community impact plan, we are advancing our commitments to support affordable housing and infrastructure, food security, early childhood education, college and career readiness, and strengthening nonprofit capacity." A growing campaign called Duke Respect Durham, which City Council member Nate Baker championed during his campaign for office, calls for Duke to invest even more through direct payments to the city and county in lieu of paying property taxes, which as a nonprofit, Duke does not pay. Price and others seem aware that their work to build lasting relationships with the Durham community is not over, and discussions are ongoing. "We know Duke would not be Duke without Durham," said Price, "and we are proud to be working in partnership with our neighbors to ensure and advance the health and well-being of our community in the century ahead." Smart says she plans to continue telling that Wall family story so that future generations never forgot that history. "This recognition happened in God's time, in due time, and I really believe it's about time," Smart said. Next, another Durham story from 35 years ago until today. A child's bicycling death haunts a Durham neighborhood. 35 years later, there's still no sidewalk. It's been 35 years since John Parker died after a pickup collided with the bike he was riding on Cheek Road in East Durham before school. He was six. His mother, Deborah Melvin Muse, doesn't display photos of him, the second youngest of six children. His brother's birthday was the day after the crash, and he hasn't celebrated it since. An older brother carries a deep sense of guilt because he was looking after John that morning. And Cheek Road, in a predominantly black neighborhood, still lacks sidewalks for children to safely make their way to the local elementary school. This despite the years community activists and academic researchers have spent pleading with city leaders for safety improvements along this busy thoroughfare with sloping shoulders where John died. Drivers zoom along Cheek Road in the Merrick Moore neighborhood, which connects downtown Durham to industrial sites and newer suburban developments. Melvin Muse moved her family out of the neighborhood after the death. She says, "Now when I go down there, I look and see, you know, nothing really changed," she said. "It still looks the same." Cheek Road has been, quote, "identified as needing improvements" by a local metropolitan planning board, said Aaron Convery, Durham's transportation planning manager, in an email. "The infrastructure that exists is not well implemented," concluded a preliminary report produced by UNC Chapel Hill students who collected data on speeding, noise, and air quality along Cheek Road. And the report added, "Poorly marked crosswalks, inadequately positioned bus stops show a need for safety and accessibility improvements." Data was difficult to collect, though, because, says Ari Schwartz, one of the researchers, quote, "there were areas we didn't want to get out of our cars because of the dangerous conditions." In the 1940s, black military veterans returning from World War II helped establish the Merrick Moore neighborhood. Since then, residents say they have endured everything from noisy industrial trucks and speeding cars to illegal tire dumping, air pollution that threaten their health and safety. Pedestrian deaths are highest in formerly redlined areas, that is, neighborhoods where black people lived because of discriminatory federal mortgage lending practices. Research shows the lack of sidewalks. Damaged walkways and roads with high speed limits are concentrated in these neighborhoods. Studies show creating a little recognized public health crisis. Governments invest in roads for people driving through such neighborhoods, but not in safety measures like sidewalks, crosswalks, traffic circles, speed bumps that protect people living in them, researchers and advocates say. Daria Minovi, a senior analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who studies environmental health and justice, has this to say. People will talk about vulnerable communities as if there's a problem with these communities, when in fact, it's our systems and policies that have created these failings. While the share of black residents in Merrick Moore has dropped in recent decades, data shows that the neighborhood remains more than 80% black or Hispanic, and households there are typically less well-off than other parts of the city. Bonita Green, head of Merrick Moore Community Development Corporation and a former city council candidate, says local government takes money from the neighborhood but does not invest in it. Green said the community group had documented more than 100 auto crashes along Cheek Road during a recent four-year span, and at least three pedestrian deaths before 2020. In this fast-growing city of roughly 300,000, students at Merrick Moore Elementary and others at a nearby high school sometimes walk along the road, where traffic is heavy. Drivers are known to disregard the 25-mile-an-hour speed limit, and the shoulders slope steeply. When longtime residents like Poncilla Brown see kids walking there or hear about another accident, they remember the death of John Parker, who was in first grade. Brown says, "I just cringe." She worked as an administrative assistant at Merrick Moore when John died. Every time it comes up, it's really vivid in my mind. On that day, someone rushed into the office and said a child had been hit by a car on Cheek Road. She ran to the scene. "I remember the way his head was turned. I remember the spot of blood on his face, like one speck of blood." Brown now also works for Merrick Moore Community Development Corporation and is now a counselor at a different school. Traffic on Cheek Road is expected to increase as the population grows in Durham and surrounding areas, according to a separate 2024 report from the UNC graduate students. It noted that during the morning school drop-off time, many cars driving on Cheek don't observe posted speed limits. Under an equity program meant to reverse the harm done to communities of color, Convery said, Durham officials are considering traffic calming measures, including traffic circles, speed cushions, and high visibility crosswalks. "We're open to future conversations that will help us achieve zero traffic deaths and injuries," said Convery. Yet, a 2017 plan that prioritized more than 600 sidewalk projects based on safety, equity, and demand did not include Merrick Moore Elementary School on Cheek Road, she said. A strike by Durham school bus drivers this year only heightened concerns about the lack of safe walking routes for the 650 students who attend the elementary school. Melvin Muse, now 67, was at work when she got a call that John had been struck by a truck in front of their house. Before she left home that late May morning in 1989, she put her older kids in charge of the younger ones. They passed the time before school riding bicycles near their house, a few blocks from the school, when the accident occurred. John died 2 months shy of his 7th birthday from massive head injuries, according to the News and Observer, who wrote about his death on Cheek Road at the time. John was buried in Markham Memorial Gardens. Melvin Muse said his death sent the family into a tailspin of grief, anger, and regret. It caused a big rip in the family. Melvin Muse and John's father later divorced. She said she paid for therapy for her other kids, but they still got in trouble at school, and two of her children ended up living in a home for kids with behavioral health issues. It was just a bad time. Years after the accident, said Melvin Muse, she worked up the courage to call the driver who had hit her son. When he answered, he didn't recognize her name or John's. Fueling her rage, she recalled. She said, I wanted revenge, an eye for an eye kind of thing, and I plotted to take him out the same way my son was taken out. She went so far as to get a job where he worked, Durham County Tax Department, only to find he had left a week before she started. She said, God knows what was in my heart and what I planned on doing. God moved him out of that place before I got there. Okay, let's briefly, well, let's leave Durham area now, move to Wake County. At an Amazon warehouse in Garner, a car designing campaign is underway. When Amazon workers in the warehouse use the restroom, they often find themselves reading a bulletin inside the stall called an installment in company jargon that highlights both the perks of working at Amazon. Did you know Amazon gives you free money for your savings? And the responsibilities of staff help us prevent bugs by only eating in approved break areas. Since last month, though, workers at the Titanic RDU1 Amazon warehouse in Garner have met a different kind of messaging on those bathroom breaks. One recent installment reads, Jeff Bezos makes $7.9 million an hour. 1 in 15 Amazon employees will be injured on the job, reads another. A third notes Bezos spent $5.5 billion on a 4-minute trip to space. Unlike the usual bulletins, these are printed in both English and Spanish, and they aren't coming from corporate management. In early September, the worker-led movement Carolina Amazonians United for Solidarity and Empowerment, or CAUSE, launched a concerted effort to get hourly workers at RDU1 to sign union cards. The push comes 2.5 years after hourly workers at the warehouse began organizing for a union. It also comes as Amazon rolls out $1.50 hourly raise for hourly workers, bringing the starting pay at RDU1 up to $18.50. For full-time workers, seasonal workers are paid $18. Ryan Brown, a pastor and an Amazon warehouse worker who founded CAUSE with co-worker Mary Hill in 2022, says the $1.50 raise is part what spurred the group's decision to initiate this card-signing effort. A lot of the people I've been having conversations with, he says, they feel insulted by the fact they're only giving us that much. Beyond posting their own installments, which feature not only statistics, but QR codes that lead directly to a virtual union card submission form in warehouse bathrooms, CAUSE members have drummed up support in recent weeks by leafleting and collecting card signatures along Jones Sausage Road, where the 2 million square foot RDU1 warehouse is located. To boost efficiency in their organizing efforts, CAUSE members have formed subcommittees for day shift workers, night shift workers, Spanish speaking workers, are in the process of building out a committee for Arabic speaking workers. There's more buzz around CAUSE now than ever before. A video of Duke football players helping to gather signatures was shared more than 1,000 times on X. Local TV affiliates and the News and Observer covered a CAUSE press conference last Wednesday, and CAUSE says hundreds of workers have signed cards in the past month. But when you step back and look at the task as a whole, it feels almost Sisyphean. 30% of hourly workers at RDU must sign union cards in order to trigger a union election with the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB. The turnover rate for hourly Amazon workers is extraordinarily high. In 2022, leaked documents showed the company's annual turnover rate, to be higher than 100%. To complicate matters further, it's not clear how many people are employed at RDU1. Amazon isn't obligated to disclose the number, and it also fluctuates. During the holidays, for instance, the warehouse will bring on scores of seasonal workers. Amazon spokesperson Eileen Hards tells the Indy that RDU currently has, quote, more than 2,000 workers. Some estimates put that number as high as 6,000. Causa's solution is to shoot for the moon. When members feel they have enough signatures, the group will send those cards to NLRB, and the NLRB will request an employee roster from Amazon. They will then check the names on the cards against the names on the roster to ensure the cards do represent 30% of the warehouse's current employees. Brown says Causa is keeping its target number of signed cards under wraps. A few years ago, he says, at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, management got wind that organizers were nearing the number of signatures they needed to trigger an election and allegedly hired more workers in an attempt to inflate the number of eligible voters. "We are playing a game of chess with Amazon," says Brown. Only one Amazon warehouse, JFK8, in Staten Island, has successfully unionized. Two other warehouses, including Bessemer, have been able to trigger elections but didn't pass them. In the event that Cause is able to land and win a union election at RDU1, the group's demands for a contract will include $30 an hour, a paid one-hour lunch break, paid sick leave and bonuses during the peak sales season, which begins in October and ends through the end of the year. In general, workers wanted to be treated more like humans and less like machines, says Brown. Most shifts last around 10 hours. Warehouse workers currently get two paid 15-minute breaks and one unpaid 30-minute lunch break per shift. However, workers often find they have very little time to actually eat during their breaks. Brown explains that if he wants to heat up his food, he usually faces a long wait in line for the microwave. "Then while I'm sitting there," he says, "I may get a text message that tells me I'm being moved to a different part of the warehouse. That might be a 12-minute walk, and I have to get there by the time the break is over, or they're going to write me up for TOT, time off task." In the weeks since Cause launched this campaign, Amazon has begun to turn up the heat on what Brown describes as union-busting tactics. He says, "At the entrance to the warehouse where employees scan badges to clock in, there's now a large TV screen that displays the message, 'You have no obligation to speak to any group or representative of a group, including a union representative.'" Amazon representatives have also begun holding messages at RDU1 labeled as, quote, "information meetings" that closely resemble captive audience meetings where corporate management discourages union organizing. While these meetings are technically voluntary, they happen during work hours, so most employees attend to take a break from being online. Some workers also fear that skipping those meetings could signal involvement in union activities, leading to potential retaliation, says Brown. A video clip of one such meeting that was obtained by the Indy depicts an Amazon representative suggesting to a room of workers that signing a union card could lead to a breach of privacy. "Union authorization cards ask for personal information from you, which can then be used by a union in lots of different ways," the representative says in the video. "The group may even share your information with other outside groups." In response to Indy's request for comment on that effort at RDU1, Hards, the Amazon spokesman, wrote, quote, "Our employees have the choice of whether or not to join a union. They always have. We favor opportunities for each person to be respected and valued as an individual and to have their unique voice heard by working directly with our team. The fact is, Amazon already offers what many unions are requesting, competitive pay health benefits on day one, and opportunities for career growth. Next, from Raleigh, a report from the two-year-old mass shooting in Headingham development in the neighborhood, pretty close to where I live, as a matter of fact. Survivors and family members of victims of that mass shooting in northeastern Raleigh's Headingham neighborhood are suing the accused shooter, his parents, the Headingham Community Association, and the private security firm Capital Special Police, according to an October 4 Wake County Superior Court filing. In a 162-page lawsuit, the plaintiffs allow that the HOA and private security firm failed to intervene to stop 15-year-old Austin Thompson's rampage through that neighborhood on October 13th of 2022, despite warnings that Thompson was dangerous. They further allege that Thompson's parents negligently allowed their son access to an, quote, arsenal of unsecured weapons, enabling him to commit the deadly shooting. The plaintiffs are family members of Headingham residents Susan Carnatz, Mary Marshall, Nicole Connors Howard, and Raleigh police officer Gabriel Torres, who Thompson shot and killed that day, as well as Marcel Garner and another police officer, Casey Clark, who survived the shooting with serious injuries. They are requesting compensatory and punitive damages from all defendants and a jury trial. Their attorney, Robert Jessup, said in a statement, "The suit seeks to hold everyone accountable who had the power to prevent this tragedy and failed to act." The complaint deals how Thompson, a known threat in the community, was allowed to roam freely with weapons, leading to the deaths of five individuals and serious injury to others, despite the clear signs of escalating violence and danger. Those responsible for the safety and security of the neighborhood did nothing to stop this tragedy from occurring. The lawsuit alleges that in the years and months leading up to this mass shooting, residents complained to the HOA about worsening crime in Headingham, including break-ins and shootings. The complaint includes, as evidence, a list of 3,800 crime incidents that reportedly took place in that neighborhood's immediate vicinity between 2014 and 2022, and a second exhibit showing crime data from January 1, 2022, up until the day of the shooting. Residents specifically complained that the private security company hired to patrol the neighborhood, Capital Special Police, quote, never did anything. The suit further alleges that HOA and Capital Special Police received multiple complaints about the accused shooter prior to 2022, including reports, quote, he had gotten into fights with people in the neighborhood, used racial slurs, seemed to pick on women especially, and talked a lot about getting weapons and bullets. The suit quotes one Headingham resident who complained to the HOA about the shooter just days before, quote, a day or two before the shooting, I saw Austin transporting backpacks full of stuff. I thought it was very strange he was doing that. I remember I alerted the HOA of his suspicious behavior, but to my knowledge, they never followed up on it. The complaint continues. It was after the shooting, residents realized the path they had observed the shooter take place was the start of the path of his spree. The lawsuit quotes another Headingham resident who says the accused shooter had targeted Nicole Connors Howard, one of the victims, previously. Quote, she was one of the women he picked on before the shooting. The complaint notes that she was shot at 34 times, more than the other victims were fired on combined. The suit contains four separate claims of negligence and gross negligence by different defendants. Subject to the first claim, the HOA, as well as HRW Inc., a Raleigh-based property management company that oversees the HOA's daily operation. The second claim names Capital Special Police and his chief of police, Roy Taylor. The third claim names Nicole Locke, the Capital Special Police security guard on duty in Headingham during the shooting. And the fourth claim is directed at the parents, Alan and Elise Thompson. Both defendants, quote, Both defendants, Allen and Elise Thompson, knew of Austin's antisocial, racist, and aggressive and violent comments and behaviors. Despite these comments and behaviors, defendants Allen and Elise Thompson allowed Austin unfettered access to their arsenal of weapons and ammunition. Allen Thompson recently pleaded guilty to improperly storing a handgun that matches evidence found near several of the shooting victims. He will serve a year's unsupervised probation for this misdemeanor charge. The suit's fifth and final claim is of assault and battery by the shooter. Plaintiffs say that in addition to the killing Carnitz, Marshall, Connors, Howard, and Torres, the accused shooter caused the two survivors, Gardner and Clark, severe emotional and physical pain and suffering, permanent injury, scarring, disfigurement, and the loss of the normal use of their body parts. The accused shooter also killed his brother, 16-year-old James Thompson, on October 13th. James's death is not mentioned in this complaint. Joseph, the plaintiff's attorney, we continue to pray for the families of the deceased and injured, and we are committed to fighting for justice to bring an end to the ongoing violence that plagues this community and continues to produce innocent victims. The suit comes in addition to a separate case against the accused shooter brought by Wake District Attorney Lauren Freeman. In that case, he is charged as an adult with 5 counts of murder. That trial is scheduled for September 22nd, 2025. Next, some culture plus humanitarian article. Statewide, this is important, and maybe even further than statewide. Musicians pulled together massive compilation for Western North Carolina flood relief. Yesterday morning, the link for Cardinals at the Window, a flood relief compilation of previously unreleased music from dozens of artists, went live on Bandcamp. The 136-track list has ambitious range, featuring live tracks from bands like REM and Phish, alongside new songs from Sharon Van Etten, Little Brother, and Sylvan Esso, and original covers, including a Waxahachie cover of Gillian Welch's Wrecking Ball, and a Watch House cover of Neil Young's Harvest Moon, put together by a trio with ties to Western North Carolina, to wit, Libby Rodenbaugh, David Walker, and Grayson Haver-Curran. Proceeds from Cardinals at the Window will be split evenly between the on-the-ground relief organizations, Rural Organizing and Resilience, ROAR, and the Community Foundation of Western North Carolina and Beloved Asheville. Rodenbaugh told the Indy, the process of quickly compiling this sprawling Everything But the Kitchen Sink musical roster astounded us, but it really grew legs of its own. We started asking folks about it on the Saturday after the storm, and by the following Wednesday, I had lost track of everybody who'd signed up. Rodenbaugh, who lives in Madison County, said, I think it has something to do with how this area gets sneakily into people's souls, even if you've just passed through. The project's title is a nod to long-held spiritual association with the Cardinal as a harbinger of hope. All of the proceeds will go to relief efforts, say the organizers, funds disseminated through a tandem fundraising campaign called Cardinals at the Window. Hurricane made landfall in Florida, as we know, and tore through Georgia, Western North Carolina, suffered brutal compounding effects of previous rainfall, communication road outages, and mudslides. Helene is now the third deadliest storm the United States has seen in this century, behind Hurricane Katrina in 2005 and Hurricane Maria 2017. The release falls on the day that Hurricane Milton, which some expect to be the storm of a century, churns towards Florida. Rodenbaugh said in the press release, in the aftermath of a natural disaster, it's important to situate this manifestation of ecological collapse within a history of inequitable exploitation of land and people. This is a region that has suffered in the name of human progress for a long time. I hope we're going to take this opportunity to start building a different kind of world in Western North Carolina and beyond. Many of the artists featured on the compilation are from Western North Carolina, such as Indigo D'Souza, Angel Olsen, Carly Hartzman, Wednesday, and Ryan Gustafson of the Dead Tongues. D'Souza, who lives in the hard-hit area of Marshall, shared images on social media of the interior of their home caked in feet of mud. On X, the Wednesday band account posted that they recorded their track contribution on their phone in Asheville, quote, during the storm, before anyone knew how bad it was because there was no phone service. And although the compilation features artists from all over, the heart of the music is firmly grounded in North Carolina, underscoring the state's vast musical talent with contributions from the likes of American Aquarium, Superchunk, the Avett Brothers, Iron and Wine, Sylvan S.O., Sonny Miles, Magic Tuber String Band, I love that name, Eric Bachman, Little Brother, H.C. McIntyre, and dozens of other Tar Heel bands. Artists from outside the state pay tribute to Carolina in tributes like Tennessee musician Adeem the Artist's cover of the Elizabeth Cotton classic Freight Train. Beyond this compilation, North Carolina has seen numerous musical fundraising efforts pulled together, including an October 21st, coming up, a Sturgill Simpson concert in Cary, an October 26th concert in Charlotte featuring Luke Combs, Eric Church, Billy Strings, and James Taylor, and an October 29th concert headlined by Ben Folds over in Wilmington. Roddenberg says there were just so many folks who, like us, had witnessed this destruction of these holy places from outside and felt their hearts trying to break out of their chests. They also feel what I feel, that these mountains are the cradle of some deep and ineffable magic. Well, let's talk about Coach K and the Duke men's basketball program. Come on, state fans and UNC fans and other local fans, let's talk about this, because John Feinstein had been a student at Duke University in the late 70s, and in his day, the basketball team was something of a joke. Feinstein tells the Indy, "When I say to people the Duke was the last in the ACC, last place in my 4 years, they think I'm lying." It didn't take long, though, for Mike Krzyzewski, an unknown former Army coach with a hard-to-pronounce name, I can attest to that, to turn the program from a laughingstock to the cream of the crop when he was hired back in 1980. Feinstein has been on the sidelines chronicling the Blue Devils' success ever since. He's a native of New York City, a decorated journalist, and the author of 42 books and counting, including the 1986 classic A Season on the Brink and other New York Times bestsellers, giving voice to some of the most memorable moments in sports. It's only appropriate that eventually he would take readers inside college basketball's most polarizing program. Right, UNC fans? Out this month, from Duke University Press, who would have believed it? 5 banners inside the Duke basketball dynasty is a fresh look at that historic program that has hovered near the apex of the basketball world for nearly 4 decades. Under Kay's tenure, Duke's men's basketball reached the summit 5 times, winning NCAA national titles 1991, 1992, 2001, 2010, 2015. 5 Banners reads more like a journal than a history book, with anecdotes from players, coaches, and other important figures throughout the program. This interview is just conducted as a Q&A, so I'll deliver my cues in an odd journalist sort of page, and then a warm Feinstein sort of a voice. Duke is such a storied program, and a lot of ink has been spilled. Why write this book now? Well, first, to give you the background, my agent is friends with the head of Duke Publishing, whose name is, believe it or not, Dean Smith. And Dean came to my agent and said, "Would John have any interest in doing a sports book for our 100th anniversary?" Dean contacted me, and I said, well, if they let me do what I want to do, I don't want to do a book on the history of volleyball or something like that. I wanted to do a book on something I knew. So I came up with this idea to write about the five championships, since I covered them all and knew Krzyzewski very well, dating back to when he was at the Army, showing how old I am. They liked the idea. Dean liked the idea, so I went ahead with it. And I think what I was trying to do, because you're right, people know the basics of the championships, and of course, there was a 30 for 30 on Christian Leitner after they won. So I wanted to write about things I knew but hadn't written about the program, about Krzyzewski, about guys like Grant Hill and guys like Johnny Dawkins and people like that. And that's what I attempted to do, build those stories around the five championships. You said you wanted to highlight things you hadn't written about, and I think that really comes through in those anecdotes about players like Nate James and Quinn Cook. I don't think anybody wins championships without Nate James, without Quinn Cook. It's interesting, the 2015 team, which is considered a one-and-done team because of the three freshmen who starred and then went on right to the NBA. But Quinn Cook, Emil Jefferson, and Marshall Plumlee were very important parts of that team. They don't win without those guys. I think one of the things that has to be learned in the post-Krzyzewski era is great to recruit star freshmen. They've got a kid right now who's allegedly going to be the number one pick in the NBA draft next year. But you need more than great freshmen. You need those role players. You need those older guys with experience. I think that's one of the things I tried to explain, especially in writing about that 2015 team. The irony was the 2010 team was the year that Mike had recruited Kyrie Irving, but won the national championship with juniors and seniors because Irving wasn't there yet. I think John Calipari learned that lesson in recent years. When did you decide you wanted to start writing books? Step one. I had to realize I wasn't going to be the point guard for the Knicks or play center field for the Mets. I knew that in high school, but when I got to college, I fell in love with newspaper journalism. I was able to write fast because I write like I talk, so I was comfortable writing fast. I loved covering different things, whether it was straight news, which I did throughout my 4 years, or covering a Duke fencing team, which I did. That was also the post-Watergate period, so everybody wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein. I was lucky enough to actually work for Bob Woodward. He's been a great friend to me for more than 40 years now, and I think everybody who writes, whether it's for a newspaper or magazine, whatever, wants to write a book at some point. I still remember a friend of mine, Phil Wood, when he interviewed me on this Baltimore talk show radio station for A Season on the Brink, said, well, I guess everybody who writes has a book in them, and John's tumbled out. And I wanted to say to him, the book's number one on the bestseller list. I think it more than tumbled out. I actually proposed a book to Dean Smith, the UNC coach, after UNC won the championship. I always had a good relationship with him, and I said, okay, you've won the championship, that monkey's off your back. You could win again next year, because they had Jordan and Sam Perkins coming back. I'd like to spend the summer reporting on your life, then be around during the season. He couldn't have been nicer. He actually said, let me think about it. Let me talk to Linnea, his wife. And he called me back and he said, you know, I'm just not ready to be as honest as I think you'd want me to be about that. I was 25, and then when I came up with the idea to do A Season on the Brink, I did get the chance, and my goal, Justin, was to write a book that would do well enough that I'd get to do a second book. I never dreamed it would be a number one bestseller, so it couldn't have worked out better for me. I interviewed Scott Ellsworth, who wrote The Secret Game about Duke and NC Central University. He mentioned A Season as something he really appreciated. He ended up writing a basketball book many years later, but to your point, he did not just tumble out either. I don't think any book tumbles out, to be honest. But yeah, I'm flattered that Scott would bring up A Season, because I love that book. And to me, I'm about to start teaching here at Longwood University, and I taught at Duke many, many years ago, before my kids were born. And one of the things, the most underrated things to me about being a reporter, a journalist, an author, is the idea. I've always been good at ideas. I've rarely taken ideas in my life from editors. One of the things I learned in my years as a newspaper guy, and I still write for the Washington Post, was don't ever put yourself in the hands of an editor for an idea, because they'll get it wrong. What do you remember about Durham from your time as a Duke student? It's a very different city today than it was in the 70s and 80s, and the relationship between town and gown has evolved as well. There was a lot of culture shock involved. I grew up in New York City. I lived in a neighborhood where I played ball most days with a diverse group, and I thought everybody was a liberal Democrat. I was shocked when there were guys crying in my dorm when Spiro Agnew retired. I was running up and down the hall screaming, "Nixon's next!" But it helped me grow, because I can remember nights in that dorm when we would sit around and argue. Lots of football players lived in my dorm, and they were mostly Midwestern, white, in case of the guys in my dorm, and conservative, and they didn't understand why I was against the Vietnam War or Richard Nixon. But they were bright guys. So even though we disagreed, it led to very interesting conversations. I went to a basketball game with my dad in Cameron, where I was visiting as a recruited swimmer, and Duke wasn't having any good back then. And when I say to people that Duke was last in the ACC in my 4 years, they think I'm lying. But they beat Maryland that day. Maryland was second in the country. Gary Melchione, who was a senior, scored 39 points. As we walked out, I said to my dad, "I'm sorry," because he wanted me to go to Yale. He was an active professor there. "If I get in here, I'm going here." Back then, Durham was still pretty much a tobacco town. There were not many good restaurants. There was the Ivy Room, which we went to, but mostly when we went out to dinner, we went to Chapel Hill. There were good restaurants there, and there were girls. So that was a very different time. Durham is a very different town. Duke's a very different school. So, like Mike Krzyzewski and coaching the basketball team, I've had to adapt to Duke being a different school than the one I graduated from. All right, it's time for my segment. I guess I've learned to call articles I can't complete reading because I've not left enough time for them. And this one is about furniture making, still active in North Carolina. From Durham, this article, tucked in a small sunlit studio in Durham, Chris Frazier hovers over a slab of wood, the rhythmic sound of her drill cutting through the peaceful silence. The scent of sawdust lingers in the air, and around her, sketched designs and unfinished projects lay scattered in a chaotic gallery of inspiration. Once celebrated as a furniture capital of the world, North Carolina cities drew craftsmen from across the nation to build a legacy of quality artistry. Even as industrialization swept through the United States and factories were moved overseas, the state remains an East Coast hub for a booming furniture market. Garden and Guns magazine's Made in the South Awards honor the best products crafted in this region today, from food and drinks to chairs and rugs. North Carolina artists took home 3 first-place finishes and 14 runners-up in the past 3 award shows, revealing not just their individual talents, but the rich cultural tapestry of the state itself. Durham, a growing city home to countless murals, galleries, and small artist-owned businesses, boasts 3 recent Made in the South awards, attracting tourists, stimulating business, and bringing residents together. Durham's arts community is a big part of what makes its neighborhoods thrive. Each award-winning piece tells a story of past and present, of North Carolina's colorful history of furniture and textile making, and how artists in the Bull City are building on that legacy, redefining what it means to be made in the South. In an unassuming corner of his Durham studio sits Elijah Leeds' award-winning Warren Cabinet. Solid, dark walnut adorns with bronze mesh, Lead describes the piece as something to tuck objects away without completely hiding them. A sleek and modern take on a centuries-old design, the Warren cabinet breathes new life in traditional craftsmanship. Leeds said, it's really a kind of cabinet of curiosities, where instead of a cabinet where you just throw your stuff in that you don't want out and hidden away, the bronze gives you a little bit of the ability to see through. Something you treasure personally inside this cabinet? It's kind of a special place for it. Though his first overall finish and made in the South brought more attention to his business, Leeds said competitions and trade shows are more about a chance for creativity than recognition. Building basic pieces and filling orders keep the lights on, but he'll take any chance he gets to transform old ideas. Quote, it's typically challenging day to day to try to find time or space to make new things or be creative in a way. I'm usually just trying to keep up with what's coming through the shop. It's a rare opportunity to have a hard stop. Is this something new or interesting? We're all doing this, all this setup, investing all this time into it. Let's go a bit further and make something entirely new as well. Leed, who studied glass and ceramics at Center College in Danville, Kentucky, said Durham has deep appreciation for handcrafted pieces and supporting local artists. I don't really have to differentiate myself or be a competitor to my peers or other people in the area that do the same thing. There's generally plenty of work for all of us to be doing. I know a lot of other folks in the area that make the same kind of handcrafted work and in their own unique way. In addition to his own work, Leed teaches glass blowing to students at North Carolina Central University. He values his glass blowing studio, one of the few in the region, as an educational resource and a way to mentor members of the community. Chris Fraser started at Elijah Leed's studio in an apprentice-like role in 2021, spending her first year at the studio learning the style of furniture before taking on more managerial role and guiding newer woodworkers. For Fraser, crafting furniture is like putting together a puzzle. And unfortunately, I will not be able to reveal to you what that puzzle discloses, because I must stop. The hounds of the clock are nibbling at my ankles. And so, John Feddersen will bid you farewell. I will not be reading for the next two issues, but there will be equally enlightened and urbane, suave reader of some form available for you at the next week's issue of Indie Week. And again, we can revisit all of these stories and lots more at IndieWeek.com if you choose. Our program here will be a podcast after Friday's initial broadcast for a whole week. We'll see you all in 3 weeks, but stay tuned anyway.